From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To The Point.
Can America's left start its own Tea Party? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To The Point. Across the country, protesters are calling on Democrats to obstruct the Trump administration wherever they can. In the U.S. Senate, Elizabeth Warren and others have got the message. They're defying Republicans by attacking Trump's nominee for attorney general. But how long can the political energy be sustained, especially when Republicans complain that they're in danger at town halls when demonstrators turn on them? Is the so-called resistance movement at risk of alienating the supporters it needs most to accomplish political change? On today's Talking Point later, President Trump is reportedly in a dispute with officials in Yemen over his first commando raid. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To The Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney back with To The Point. Opposition to the Trump administration has gone from the streets to the floor of the U.S. Senate, where Democrats are protesting a cabinet nomination, even though they have no chance of winning. We'll ask, how far is too far for opposition to be effective? Today's Talking Point, the White House called last week's attack in Yemen a success, but the deaths of children and other civilians have Yemeni officials reportedly saying otherwise. We heard about the president's first dispute about a commando raid. First, this news update. President Trump took a shot at the federal judiciary today in a speech to police chiefs of major cities. After addressing threats of crime, he turned to Judge James Robart's temporary restraining order against his ban on refugees and immigrants from seven mostly Muslim countries.
I don't ever want to call a court biased, so I won't call it biased. And we haven't had a decision yet. But courts seem to be so political, and it would be so great for our justice system if they would be able to read a statement and do what's right. And that has to do with the security of our country, which is so important.
Robert Barnes is Supreme Court reporter for The Washington Post. Hi, Robert. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Apparently, the president was listening last night to those arguments before the three-judge panel that's considering Judge Robart's restraining order. It sounds as if he had a reaction to that.
Yeah, it sounds like he did listen. He says he did. And, he said that he heard things from these judges he couldn't believe. He stopped short of criticizing them, as he did there, but you feel that it's just around the corner if it goes against him. The president has, to a degree, I think, different from other presidents, been sharply critical of judges. And, it's a place I think we've never been that basically within 3 weeks of inauguration, a president is locked in quite a heated legal battle that seems like it'll come to the Supreme Court pretty soon.
And blaming the judiciary in advance for a problem if, in fact, there is some threat to our security.
Yeah, he did that the other day in a tweet about Judge Robart, said that if something bad happens, it will be the court's fault.
In addition, when he was speaking to the chiefs of police today, he also painted a very bleak picture of crime and gangs and drugs in America, which seems to be at variance with what a lot of people believe.
Well, there is some evidence that murders ticked up and that crime ticked up a little bit. But if you look at the big picture, it has gone down. And the president all along, remember in the campaign, was saying this, that things were really off track, that crime was getting worse, that immigrants were pouring across the border. He painted that picture during the campaign, and I think that it had a lot to do with why he got elected.
How did the police chiefs react to him?
Very well. He had a lot of support from the law enforcement community during the campaign, and you saw the same thing today.
He went so far as to say that the order, the ban order, was within his executive powers and that a bad high school student would understand this. He's getting more and more critical of the judiciary in more and more ordinary terms.
Well, he put it in very plain terms. I thought he actually did a good job with that of sort of making it understandable to people. But, you know, you also think that the president's words are going to come back to haunt him in some way. The argument before the Ninth Circuit yesterday turned in part on, you know, do you look at just what this executive order does, or do you look behind it? Do you see what the president's motives were, what the president's intentions were? And the lawyer arguing for the federal government says, no, no, you don't do that. The president has the authority to make these decisions. You look at the decision that he issued. But more than one of the judges said, well, no, we can't do that. You know, he said during the campaign that he wanted a complete ban on Muslims. You say that this isn't that, but we have to take that into consideration. You know, there were comments from Rudy Giuliani that he wanted a Muslim ban but wanted to find a way that would be legal to do it. And so, you know, those kind of comments are hurting him in the court as well.
States of Washington and Minnesota making the arguments in the other direction. But this is really an argument, it seems to me, about the separation of powers.
Well, you know, it certainly does seem that way. And this is a president who came in, who said he was going to be a disruptor and was not going to worry about niceties. And I think you see on the Senate floor last night, you know, really high tensions about some of the president's cabinet nominees. You already see battles in the courts all over the place. This suit by Washington and Minnesota has gotten the most attention, but, you know, I think there are 18 suits like this around the country. The president's side has won one of them. And so there, you know, really feels like there are fires all over the place.
Okay. We're going to spend the rest of our program, or most of the rest of our program, talking about what happened on the Senate floor last night and what's happening today, and about the effort to build a resistance to the Trump administration. Robert Barnes, again, Supreme Court reporter for The Washington Post. Good to have you back with us.
Always happy to talk to you.
In a moment, can America's left start its own Tea Party? On To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. After controversial decisions by the new Trump administration, Democrats around the country are besieged by crowds of constituents. Delaware Senator Sheldon Whitehouse faced an outcry because of his vote in favor of a Trump cabinet nominee.
Do you get it?
What's the party strategy?
All right. Let me first with the party strategy. We are prepared to use our filibuster wherever we can hold 41 senators so that it is actually effective.
Make sure you're one of them.
Appears that some Democrats do get it. Last night, during Senate debate on Jeff Sessions' nomination for Attorney General, Elizabeth Warren was shut down when she tried to read a letter about Sessions by the widow of Dr. Martin Luther King.
Senators impugn the motives and conduct of our colleague from Alabama as warned by the chair.
Warren responded this way.
Mr. President, I am surprised that the words of Coretta Scott King are not suitable for debate in the United States Senate. I ask leave of the Senate to continue my remarks.
Is there objection?
Okay. Object.
I appeal the ruling.
Objection is heard. The senator will take her seat.
And this morning, Minority Leader Chuck Schumer recalled a past incident when Republican Ted Cruz called Republican McDonnell himself a liar.
Suggesting that the distinguished majority leader had repeatedly lied to the press. A comment made by a fellow Republican, by the way, that was fine. Reading the letter of a civil rights icon, at least to the other side, unacceptable.
Kate Zernike reports for the New York Times. She's author of a book called Boiling Mad, Behind the Lines in Tea Party America. Thanks so much for joining our program.
Thanks, Warren.
Does this sound familiar to you?
Yeah, it does sound familiar to me, particularly the White House clip that you played, not the Sheldon White House clip you played, from this time to this time from the left, really sort of focusing on their own, on its own members, the Democratic Party, to hold the line and to sort of show backbone. It's the same thing we saw in 2009 when you had Republicans or Tea Party Republicans pushing Republican lawmakers to not be Republicans in name only, as they called them.
So those are the similarities. There are many others as well. What are the differences?
Well, I mean, obviously, I think that the major difference is the ideological one or the political one. But there are some other differences that I think we just don't know yet. One of the things is the Tea Party was very aggressive about going after Republicans with primary challenges, and they really felt like they wanted to push the Republican Party to the right. I don't think we are yet seeing. I think we're this new movement, and it's, you know, nobody even knows what to call it. I guess, you know, you can call it the resistance. That's obviously a loaded term, but. From the left, the small R resistance is saying, Democrats need to stiffen their spines. They aren't yet saying, you don't hear them saying necessarily that they want to pull the party to the left. I think most of the people I talked to for a piece I wrote this week really just feel like it's about reminding the Trump administration and reminding Republicans, particularly in states that went for Hillary Clinton, that there is a great moderate population out there, and they don't want Republicans to go along with just sort of solely be a rubber stamp for President Trump.
How important was the Women's March that occurred on the day after President Trump was sworn in?
I think it was enormous. First of all, because the sheer numbers surprised anyone. I think there was a lot of expectation that you wouldn't see a lot of people turning out. It took a lot of organization, but they did get women out. And so I think that was really important. But also, you know, in talking to a lot of the groups now out in the country, a lot of the groups that are following this new indivisible handbook, which is a guide that some former congressional staffers have written to sort of educate the left on how to be more like the Tea Party, be effective in the elections. The groups that I've talked to really felt energized by that women's movement. It was very interesting to me. This is one of the similarities with the Tea Party. I was talking to a group in Morristown, New Jersey, that's gone from, you know, a handful of people to 400 people showing up at a Republican congressman's office. And the women there were talking much the way that some Tea Partiers did when I interviewed them in 2009. The Tea Party had a rally in September of 2009 in Washington. And when you talk to people, it was like this was the most energizing, amazing thing they'd done with their life. They really felt like they were, crusading and working for a real cause. And when you talk to people about the Women's March, they were talking about how energizing it was, you know, driving down the New Jersey Turnpike and stopping at rest stops, and you'd have just packs of women, and there were so many women they had to use the men's bathroom, and they were so excited, and they broke into song. I mean, they really described this as sort of transformational and energizing. I think what's, you know, the biggest similarity here that we are seeing between these two sides is that the Tea Party created incredible energy on the right in 2009 and then for the 2010 midterms. Right now, it's early, but we do see the same energy on the left.
Now, you heard earlier the crowd at Senator Whitehouse's rally. He, of course, is a Democrat. Tom McClintock, a very conservative Republican from the Sacramento area of California, had to be escorted out of the room by the police.
Right. And he's not the only one. There was actually, in Colorado, there was a similar instance where a congressman left out the bat. He was greeted by 150 people at one of his, I think he had weekly office hours. And normally, you know, maybe a handful of people showed up, but 150 showed up. He met with about half of them and then left out the back door. And police put up crime scene tape so he could go out the back door. What's interesting to me about
all of this— He was a Republican, too?
He was a Republican, and we had a similar thing. I believe it was in Georgia. I may be wrong. It may have been Florida.
I think Florida, yeah.
Yeah. What's interesting to me is the way that these Republicans are talking about it, because they're, you know, obviously we had these instances, or the instance at Berkeley, where there was violence by this sort of, what they're, you know, people calling themselves anarchists. But these are peaceful demonstrations outside these congressmen's offices. But what's interesting is the way the representatives are talking about them is saying, the police told me there was violence, that there was a real threat here. You've had other senators' offices shut down their local offices because they say that there is it's a security threat. And I think what they're trying to do is paint the protesters on the left sort of the way they did Occupy Wall Street. You know, these are dirty people. These are, loud, angry, obnoxious, violent people. And of course, the Tea Party liked to say that they were like the protesters on the left, but they cleaned up after themselves and they were much nicer. So another similarity on the left right now is that the people I talk to who are following this indivisible handbook all say, we're being very polite. We are respectful of our congressmen. So it's just interesting to see how each side is trying to complain, sort of portray itself, and how the Republicans are trying to portray it as much more violent.
When you talk about Republicans, Tom McClintock, the congressman from near Sacramento, said it's great when we're talking with each other but not shouting at each other. And then he said, once in our history we stopped talking with each other. That was the election of 1860, so he is suggesting that maybe we're moving toward another civil war, I suppose. Let me introduce Ezra Levin. He's co-author of Indivisible. That's a practical guide for resisting the Trump agenda. He's also a former staffer to Congressman Lloyd Doggett. Ezra Levin, good to have you with us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
What's the practical guide? What should people do to resist the Trump agenda?
Well, so the theory of change in the practical guide is that Donald Trump's agenda does not depend on Donald Trump. It depends on whether individual members of Congress choose to fight that agenda or choose to rubber stamp it. So we actually really took the lead from the Tea Party. We thought, putting aside their 19th century policy ideology and putting aside actually what I would argue were sometimes violent or very aggressive tactics, that they got a couple pieces of strategy and the basic tactics really right. They were smart to focus locally. They were smart to engage in defense, and they were smart to engage in kind of civics 101, going to member of Congress's offices, going to public events, calling them, and staying engaged on a week-to-week basis.
How concerned are you about this Republican response attempting to paint the people, your people, as violent and as risking law and order? Isn't that a threat to the very people that you really need to get the most, who are some Trump supporters, who aren't happy about what he's been doing, or some anti-Trump people who are, in fact, moderate?
First of all, I would say these are not, quote unquote, my people. This is an organic, locally led movement that is really being led at the ground level. That said, in the guide that we put out, we are very explicit that you should engage in nonviolent tactics, that you should be respectful, that you should model progressive values and have an inclusive group. We actually think that if you do the things like we saw in Berkeley, which we think is a real anomaly, that actually will discredit the rest of the movement. And everything else that we've seen, from the women's marches to the indivisible action to other work that folks are doing on the ground, is actually quite respectful. It is nonviolent. It's really just citizens standing up and trying to make their voices heard.
Kate Zernike, back to you with the New York Times. Tell our listeners, remind those who haven't seen it, what did happen in Berkeley?
Well, you had a right-wing speaker who was coming to speak, and there were rather violent demonstrations. You would probably know better because you're close to the action, but violent demonstrations to protest this speaker. So I think, I can't remember, was it $100,000 in damage, I believe?
Something along those lines, yeah. Sproul Plaza, which, interestingly enough, was a location for the free speech movement back in the 1960s.
Right.
And the speaker was from Breitbart, one of their most vitriolic people, who is full of nasty attacks. Ezra Levin, back to you. There were broken windows. There was, as just indicated, thousands of dollars worth of damage. And then Donald Trump threatened, perhaps, to withhold support for the University of California because they wouldn't let the speaker continue. How much of a threat is that?
So, our theory of change here is that you can engage in the federal policy process by convincing your member of Congress to act a certain way, that every member of Congress wakes up every morning thinking about re-election, which means they're thinking about how they convince their constituents that they're working for them in Congress. A great way to influence your member of Congress is to call them, or even better yet, show up. A not great way of convincing members of Congress to your side is to engage in violent acts. That's actually a good way to drive them away. So we set out a few pretty simple tactics, and we strongly encourage people to do those and other creative, nonviolent ways of engaging with the political process. And I think they are doing that. I wouldn't blow the Berkeley event out of proportion. As bad as it was, it is a rarity that you were not seeing that around the country. What we're seeing around the country are thousands and thousands of people every day standing up and going in a peaceful way to their member of Congress's offices and to public events.
Ezra Levin, again, author of A Practical Guide for Resisting the Trump Agenda. Varad Mehta is with us. He's an historian, a contributor to the National Review, conservative magazine. His most recent article was titled, "Resistance is Facile." Thank you very much for being on our show.
Thanks for having me, Warren. How are you?
You said that using the term resistance is actually doing a disservice to the democratic values that people like Ezra Levin claim to be upholding. What do you mean by that?
Well, my argument there was that you think about the term resistance, right? The images and associations it brings up are things like, you know, the French resistance in World War II or the Warsaw Uprising, the Czech resistance, something like that historically, where they're resisting violently, you know, a hostile alien invading power, you know, Nazi Germany. Whereas the opposition to Donald Trump, they're supposedly resisting, you know, the legitimately and democratically elected president of the United States. So I think the idea that you're resisting somebody who was put into the White House through our normal electoral processes is kind of a non sequitur. And then as Ezra was saying, these people, for the most part, are engaging in the normal tools of democracy, protesting and calling their congressmen and, you know, satire, comedy, that sort of thing. So I think that what they're doing is normal run-of-the-mill stuff. It's not a resistance. And I think the idea of a resistance, contradicts the idea of democracy that they're trying to uphold.
On the other hand, they want to generate opposition. What's wrong with using the term, presuming it's metaphorical? They're not talking about an invading power, obviously.
They're not, but at the same time, if there are resistance, you know, if they're fighting fascism, you know, there's this, you know, anti-fascist element there that I think was part of the violence in Berkeley. You know, if you're an anti-fascist, what do you oppose? Fascism. So whatever you oppose must be fascism. So there's also this, I think that by elevating themselves to the level of resistance, they're also elevating Trump into this sort of existential mortal threat that must be resisted at all costs. And just to speak a little bit about Berkeley, there are there are five or six columns in today's, I think it's the Daily Californian, the Berkeley student newspaper, all of which are justifying the violence. So, if Trump is that, a mortal threat, then any means are necessary, including violent resistance. So they're buying into their own rhetoric. We're a resistance. So Trump is this threat and he must be opposed however we do it, by any means necessary.
So you're saying it's counterproductive.
It's absolutely counterproductive. The Women's March accomplished so much more, just by being normal, American citizens exercising their First Amendment rights to gather in a public space and show that, we don't like Trump.
All right, hold that thought. We're going to come back in just a moment after we take a very brief break on our talking point. Later, President Trump is reportedly in a dispute with officials in Yemen over his first commando raid. We'll hear about that a little bit later in a moment. We'll come back, continue this conversation with all our guests. We'll also have Vanessa Williamson from the Brookings Institution, who's written a book about the Tea Party and the remaking of Republican conservatism. Warren Olney back with To The Point, talking today about opposition to President Trump, starting with the Women's March right after he was inaugurated, spreading around the country to demonstrations of all kinds, particularly involving politicians of both party. Ezra Levin has written Indivisible, a practical guide for resisting the Trump agenda. Ezra, we heard a moment ago from Varad Mehta that by using the term resistance, what you do is elevate Donald Trump to a sort of moral threat comparable to fascism or Hitler. He says that the Daily Cal at Berkeley, the student newspaper there, has been justifying violence. Are you concerned about that?
So I think I'd have three things to say. One, Donald Trump's administration and the agenda that he's put forward and the overreach being exhibited by this Republican Congress, I think does represent an existential threat to many Americans. If you're a Muslim American, if you're somebody who cares about widespread surveillance of Americans, if you're somebody who cares about the basic tenets of American democracy, like an independent judiciary or freedom of the press or freedom of religion, that scares me. I think it should scare other folks on the ground. So I wouldn't diminish the level of threat that this administration, this Congress, poses. But getting into this article, I read it. I thought it was interesting. I think we're kind of debating about word choice a little bit. But if we want to talk about whether resistance is somehow counter to American culture, you know, I would look at the founding fathers. I would look at actually the Federalist Papers. Look at Madison in Federalist 61, who considers the possibility of an encroaching federal government and actually uses the words resistance. He says that plans of resistance would be concerted. So I think resistance is actually baked into American history, and we shouldn't be scared of that word. Resistance is real. Resistance is happening now. I would say resistance happened under the Tea Party as well. Now, when it really comes to where the rubber hits the road and what resistance means, I don't think there's any disagreement here. We're talking about going to congressional district offices. We're talking about making calls. We're talking about going to public events. If you want to call that civic happy fun time instead of resistance, be my guest. As long as folks are actually going out and making their voice heard, call it what you will.
So, Varad Mehta, it's all in a word.
Well, it isn't a word, but I think language is important. You know, Ezra is, I think, rare in conceding that what the Tea Party was doing was a form of resistance. You know, in my article, I did go back and look at some of the, news reporting from, 2009, 2010 about the Tea Party and then just about, the Republicans in Congress. And you never see the word resistance used about what they were doing, We've all heard about, Republican obstructionism in Congress, even though now the Democrats are doing many of the same things. They're trying to stop Trump's cabinet nominees. They're going to try to filibuster Neil Gorsuch, the Supreme Court nominee. So it's the same stuff, but it's resistance because the Democrats are doing it. It wasn't resistance when the Republicans were doing it. And I think that language confers a moral valence. You know, how you describe something, can make it, can cast it in a positive light or a negative light. Hamlet said, nothing good or bad, but thinking make it so. And I think that it, instead of trying to make, buy into the idea of a resistance, taking it for granted, I think the media should be doing a better job of interrogating the idea itself, instead of say, okay, there was a resistance because the resistance says it is a resistance. It should try to be looking at, comparing it to what the Tea Party was doing and then saying, looking at the idea of resistance generally. I know we can go back to, say, the Founding Fathers, but at the same time, what they were resisting was the government in England in which they had no ability to participate. They couldn't vote. They weren't represented in parliament or anything like that. So in that sense, it is different.
So one person's obstructionism then may be another's resistance or vice versa. Let me change the subject a bit with Vanessa Williamson. She's a fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. She's co-author of The Tea Party and the Remaking of Republican Conservatism. Vanessa Williamson, welcome to you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
What are some of the tools that the Tea Party had that the current resistance or obstructionists of the Democratic side, the left side, didn't have?
Well, first of all, I'll say that I think that, you know, what the Indivisible folks have been doing is a really smart approach to sort of using methods that actually, you know, came from the Tea Party, but before that, you know, came from the left. I so frequently, when I was talking to Tea Party activists, they would do things like, quote, Saul Alinsky to me, you know? So I think that, well, you know, what a part of this is just ideas coming full circle.
Well, Saul Alinsky, of course, was virtually a socialist, I believe, and very much a leftist activist in the 30s.
Absolutely. So, but there are some real important differences. You know, not all ideas operate the same in every context, right? So, for instance, one important thing that is truer on the right than on the left is that the right has a very consolidated media structure that means that it's quite easy to reach the sort of demographics of people who would be interested in the Tea Party through conservative radio, through things like Fox News. And the left has a really more scattershot media structure. So it's harder to get this sort of idea, whether you want to call it the resistance or back then the Tea Party, get that idea in front of the people who would be most interested in hearing about it. So that's one challenge. The other thing that's different, I think, about the situation on the right and the left, or at least we're not sure that it's yet the same, is that when grassroots Tea Party activists responded to the Obama administration with you know, public protests, substantial elements of the elite Republican Party looked at those protests and said, you know, we can work with that. You know, this is this sort of grassroots activism that at the beginning was not particularly, you know, coalesced behind a particular policy platform or anything like that. They looked at those protests and thought, yeah, we can use this energy to promote, you know, a particular set of conservative ideas. So groups like Americans for Prosperity, you know, really benefited from sort of jumping on that Tea Party bandwagon. And I think the question is, we've seen the sort of similar, maybe, you know, fundamentally much larger grassroots response, even faster, even though Tea Party reacted fast on the left. And the question is, what sort of institutions on the Democratic side are ready to harness that energy?
When you see the sort of thing we have in the Senate over the last couple of days with Elizabeth Warren, and apparently there's going to be more today when the Senate continues to debate the nomination of Jeff Sessions to be Attorney General, is that the sort of thing that you're talking about? Is this the establishment seizing the moment, or are you talking about the political supporters, the contributors, the organizations behind the politicians themselves?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, it's definitely clear to me, at least, that the Senate Democrats have gotten a lot more backbone all of a sudden when they, you know, had these experiences of meeting with their constituents. And I think that that's, you know, a very impressive piece of political activism. But it'll take, you know, weeks and maybe months before we can really see, you know, whether organizations are in place to make this energy last.
Again, Vanessa Williamson is author of The Tea Party and the Remaking of Republican Conservatism. We have another guest. Our first guest, Kate Zernike with The New York Times, has also written very extensively and has a book as well called Boiling Mad, Behind the Lines in Tea Party America. What do you say to what we just heard? And did the Tea Party have a huge advantage that the leftists don't because of talk radio?
Well, I think it was talk radio, and I think it was also Fox. I mean, on the left, what we've seen, you know, we've seen a lot of Rachel Maddow in particular on MSNBC has talked a lot about resistance and Indivisible and their efforts, you know, the efforts of local groups that are using the Indivisible Guide. So I think that's one thing, but it's nothing like, you know, Sean Hannity going out and going to Tea Party rallies as he did. So certainly we don't have that. I think talk radio was also huge for the Tea Party. The other thing I wanted to talk about, just to add to what Vanessa said, is the other thing that we don't know is how this is going to play out for – the energy is enormous, right? And it's going to be enormously helpful to the Democrats, I think, even without them needing to harness it in the way that groups like Americans for Prosperity and FreedomWorks did on the right. But I think one thing that we don't know is just take, for example, someone like Claire McCaskill in Missouri, who's up for re-election in the next midterms. You know, we're calling it a toss-up race, because Missouri is definitely sort of a swing state and tends to lean red. So I guess the question is, you know, if Claire McCaskill shows this backbone small R resistance wants her to show, is she going to alienate sort of, you know, right-leaning voters in her state? Does she stand a chance of losing her reelection? So that's going to be a real question, is how do Democrats in red states balance these, sort of harness this energy without alienating the more moderate people they need to win reelection?
Ezra Levin, back to you, the co-author of Indivisible, A Practical Guide for Resisting the Trump Agenda, former aide to a congressman, Lloyd Doggett. Do you think that the Democrats on the left ought to be challenging those Democratic incumbents, as the Tea Party did with Republican incumbents, if they don't vote the way they want them to?
I think in elections, if you give somebody a choice between a Republican light and a Republican, they'll probably vote for the real deal. I think if Democrats want to motivate their base, they got to actually stick to their values. And I actually think there's a reason why 2 weeks ago, 15 Democrats voted for President Trump's awful nominee for CIA director, who endorses widespread surveillance of Americans, slanders Muslim Americans, and is open to torture. And yet yesterday, zero Democrats voted for his awful Secretary of Education choice. And the reason why is because they're hearing from their constituents that they expect their senators to stand up for basic American values, and if they're Democrats, to stand up for basic progressive values.
So you think there's been a change then since the vote for CIA director and now the vote for education director? Then that change has been motivated, do you think, by the demonstrations that we've been talking about?
Oh, I think without a doubt. And it's not just me thinking that. There are reports from Senate and congressional offices that they've gotten the message. And I think you've seen a visible change in behavior in the last couple of weeks as a result. And I hope they stick to it. And if they don't, I think they're going to have more interesting experiences with their constituents.
By that, you mean they will be challenged when they run for reelection?
Well, I mean, I think that's a decision that's made by their constituents. I'm in D.C. I have no senators. But if constituents feel like they're not being represented by their members of Congress or members of the Senate, they'll probably look for other representatives.
Vanessa Williamson, back to you. Do you see the Democrats, the incumbents in the Congress as well as in the Senate? We've certainly seen some in the Senate. Are they beginning to come around? Are they listening to the voice of the people, if you will? And will they continue to do that, particularly those in the Senate who, as we just heard, are in red or red-leaning states and who are up for re-election and could very easily offend a majority of their constituents?
Well, I think I agree with Ezra about this. I think that it's clear that the Senate has been responding pretty strongly to what they've been hearing from their constituents. And that's, you know, and that's not only in blue states. I mean, you've been seeing tremendous turnout in a number of swing states to, you know, just people wanting to talk to their representatives directly. And I think that's that can only be good for the sort of health of our democracy, especially, you know, in the context we're in now, where a lot of basic democratic norms are under threat. I think it's a really powerful statement from the American people.
You use the phrase the health of our democracy. Have we been ignoring democracy over a long period of time? Have we been lazy as a country about taking advantage of the rights and privileges that we have to exercise the franchise be, in fact, the governing body of the country?
Well, I mean, there's been a long-term trend since the 1960s of a sort of decline in civic engagement, in the old style of civic engagement. Increasingly, you know, lobbying is done by folks like in Washington, where I am, right? And there's sort of a professional class of people who manage nonprofits. A long time ago, you weren't a member of an organization because you sent a check or got an email. You actually attended a meeting. Right, and in meeting with other people with similar values, you practice democracy. Right, this is what Tocqueville called the great free schools of democracy, or our associations. Well, that model of organizing in this country has been in decline for a number of decades, and I think that one of the most exciting aspects of the last few weeks is the possibility that some of that civic engagement has returned.
Ezra Levin, is that what you're trying to generate?
Well, yeah, what we're talking about here is nothing brand new. This is really about just civics. This is about getting people engaged, getting people to talk to their neighbors and their fellow constituents, and making sure that they let their representatives know where they stand. So we're seeing a lot of that already. Some of that is coming out of Indivisible. Some of that is coming out of a lot of other great groups, national and local, that have been trying to organize this for a while. And we can't wait to see where it goes.
Vanessa Williamson, what about corporations who have gotten involved in all of this? Uber and Nordstrom dumping Ivanka Trump's shoe line, and the $24 million in donations over one weekend to the ACLU. How important are those elements in all of this?
Well, I think that, you know, the overall impact of sort of, you know, huge corporate investments in our democracy is probably not a great thing, right? That occasionally maybe there can be like some small offset when a bunch of people, you know, give small dollar donations, but I think it makes it a really uphill battle. But when you have the kinds of incredibly obvious and incredibly, I mean, just different from what we've seen in the past, conflict of interests that exist in the Trump administration, this is a, you know, generally speaking, terrible thing. The only silver lining I can imagine is that it creates some additional levers of expressing your opposition to the Trump administration, right? So if the Trump family continues to be engaging in business and they think they can do business as usual, I think that it offers people who oppose their agenda an opportunity to show them that it can't be business as usual.
A lot of issues this time around. Kate Zernike, back to you with the New York Times, our first guest. Your book, Boiling Mad, Behind the Lines in the Tea Party America. Are the Democrats boiling mad yet?
Well, I think certainly these groups around the country that we're seeing are boiling mad. I mean, I don't think, you know, they're just turning out in phenomenal numbers. And it's not, you know, it's, again, another, I had a story, I guess it was in yesterday's paper, and, it, you know, people would say, oh, they're all George Soros paid protesters. Well, you had everyone saying they were Koch paid protesters on the other side. And the reality is, in both cases, this started out because people were genuinely angry and they were coming out for all the things that Vanessa and Ezra are talking about. This is, you know, this is just basic civics. Once again, people are realizing that they, you know, someone said to me, we have so much power. It was, you know, sort of a revelation to her. She said, wow, we can do so many things.
Kate Zernike, once again, national correspondent for the New York Times. Her book, Boiling Mad, Behind the Lines in the Tea Party America. Thanks so much for being with us. Thanks to Ezra Levin. His book is Indivisible, A Practical Guide for Resisting a Trump Agenda. He's also a former staff member to a congressman on Capitol Hill. Farhad Mehta, who has problems with the use of the term resistance. His article, Resistance is Facile, in the National Review, where he's a contributor as well as a historian. And Vanessa Williamson at the Brookings Institution, co-author of The Tea Party and the Remaking of Republican Conservatism. We'll see about the remaking of Democratic Liberalism as time goes on, if that's the appropriate term. Progressivism maybe is a better term. Anyhow, we'll be looking at all of this and hope all of you will be able to join us again as time goes on. Thanks very much to you all. In a moment, reaction to President Trump's first commando raid. This is To the Point from Public Radio International. Warren Olney here with today's talking point. Last month, President Trump authorized his first commando raid, an attack in Yemen, which killed children and other civilians and a member of the Navy's highly regarded SEAL Team 6. Here's how it was described yesterday by White House spokesman Sean Spicer.
The raid that was conducted in Yemen was an intelligence gathering raid. That's what it was. It was highly successful. It achieved the purpose it was going to get, save the loss of life that we suffered and the injuries that occurred.
John McCain, senator from Arizona, of course, has described that raid as a failure. And the New York Times is reporting that officials in Yemen don't regard it as a success either. Here is the national security correspondent David Sanger. Always good to have you on our program.
Great to be back with you, Warren.
I understand today that Mr. Spicer doubled down on what he'd said about John McCain. Anybody who undermines the success of the raid owes an apology. It's a disservice to the life of Chief Ryan Owens. He is the SEAL Team 6 member who was killed. Tell us more about what's happening and how Yemen is responding.
Well, Yemen is responding in a pretty predictable way. This raid did almost everything that could go wrong with this raid did, Warren. We have to start with that. So if Mr. Spicer is saying it's a success, he's measuring that by the quality of the intelligence that was scooped up inside the house. He's accurately said this was intended not to get people but to gather intelligence. And from everything that we've learned, that the intelligence they got hasn't been assessed yet. So it's hard to know whether or not the raid was worth the yield in intelligence that they got. Certainly, it was costly in human life. There was, as you said, a Navy SEAL chief petty officer who was killed in this, a veteran of the SEALs. And there were a lot of Yemeni civilians who appear to have been killed. And if you believe the Yemenis, including an 8-year-old girl, the daughter of Anwar al-Awlaki, the American-born cleric who was himself killed by an American drone strike some 5 years ago. So I think the point that Mr. Spicer was making today was that when John McCain called this a failure following a classified briefing that the Senate Armed Services Committee reached, he said calling it a failure was doing a disservice, I think, to the life of the Navy SEAL who died.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we have had other military operations that did not succeed, but where we have celebrated the heroic lives of those who attempted it. And in this particular case, what the Yemenis have done, and as we reported in the Times last night and this morning, was that they have cut off, suspended the permission for the United States to run ground raids in Yemen. Now, the Yemeni foreign minister, confronted with the story this morning, had to come up with a good wording for that, and he called it a reassessment because he is caught between an American and other Western military that support his government and a very outraged group of civilians.
Tell us, if you will, what you meant when you said everything that could go wrong went wrong.
Well, they had intended to sweep in on a moonless night, very quietly, hit this house, have a minimum of casualties, grab up what they needed to grab up, and get out. Instead, the Yemenis heard them coming. The al-Qaeda-affiliated fighters mixed themselves in with the civilians in this town. They got into a 50-minute firefight. The SEALs had to call in reinforcements. One of their planes, an Osprey, took a very hard landing, went down. They decided it needed to be destroyed, so they had to fire on their own plane after, fortunately, everybody was out of it, and destroy that $70 million plane. And they lost a SEAL in the midst of it. So not likely to go down in history as sort of a model case of how you do a quick in-and-out attack.
Is it possible that assessment might change if, in fact, it turns out the intelligence that was scooped up is vitally important?
If the intelligence that's scooped up is vitally important, people may say at a very high cost, we got what we needed to get. They had hoped, of course, to get it at a low cost. Now, that's not President Trump's fault necessarily. That's not the military's fault. There are lots of missions that we saw happen in the Bush administration and the Obama administration where the plan didn't survive first contact with the enemy, to use the old line, and there was, you know, things went wrong. Happens all the time. Even in the bin Laden raid, you'll remember we lost a helicopter.
What about the moonlight in this particular case? You mentioned that it was supposed to be a moonless night. Evidently, President Obama was thinking very seriously about this same raid, but held off on the ground that it wouldn't be dark enough. Did they wait for a moonless night?
They did wait for a moonless night, and the reason that this came up was that President Obama was basically being asked to make two decisions. One was about the raid itself, but secondly was a larger question, which he deferred to the Trump administration, to whether or not the decisions on doing these kinds of raids can now be left largely to the Pentagon to make by themselves. Does every one of these need to go up to the White House and to the NSC for a full review? And that's a decision that I think President Trump still has to make. And given the fact that this plan went so awry, he may view it differently now than he did 4 days into his administration when he sat down at dinner with his new Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and Steve Bannon, and Michael Flynn, and many others, and the Vice President, to go through the decision-making on this raid.
Are these kinds of decisions normally made at dinner?
Usually not. They're usually made in the Situation Room, where you can have a full legal review, you can discuss the combat risks, the civilian risks, and so forth. When I asked this question at the White House, they said, well, look, it had been vetted during the Obama era, which is true, and the president's got confidence in his military staff, so whether he's sitting in the Situation Room or at the dinner table doesn't make any difference. I've heard different versions of that from different people who've been through that process.
Sean Spicer, the press secretary, referred to intelligence about ISIS. In fact, this was intelligence about al-Qaeda on the peninsula, which is a very different group. Is that right?
It is. This is al-Qaeda, not ISIS. ISIS and al-Qaeda obviously split away from each other many years ago.
So what are we? What's the bottom line here, do you think, about this incident and about the first opportunity for the Trump administration and for the president himself to make this kind of decision? What do you think the fallout's going to be?
Well, a couple of things. First, it reinforces the degree to which you have to think about your allies and the degree to which they are working together and thinking together about these. I think part of the anger that you heard from the Yemenis comes from the fact they weren't really consulted, nor was almost anybody in Congress and elsewhere. That's not necessarily unusual. Second is the degree to which you want the president digging in hard on this kind of stuff prior to making a first decision on a first raid. So, you know, you want to learn what kind of questions to ask. You want to learn what you don't know. Later on in his presidency, we heard of President Obama making such decisions from the golf course. So there's not anything necessarily wrong with doing it from the dinner table. But when you're doing it the first time and you're not even sort of familiar with what the issues are, you might imagine why you might want to do it a little more deeply.
Well, there might be those who would argue that it's not a good idea to do this on the golf course either.
That's right. That's right. Now, you know, what President Obama's aides would tell you is he did these on the golf course only after there had been full vetting and review in previous Situation Room meetings, and the decision he was simply making was to give a go order for something that they had fundamentally decided to do before.
Okay.
But I think the crucial issue is, at the beginning of a presidency, you want to ask the maximum number of questions you can.
David Sanger, national security correspondent for The New York Times, as always, thanks.
Great to be with you, Warren.
I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.